This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other courses or to access other materials from RTS, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.
One other thing about it came to my mind as I was talking to some of you at break, in terms of Egypt and the whole symbolism of the serpent. Is there not maybe some connection with Genesis 3:15? In the Exodus event with the plagues, God is not fully and completely, but it's a blow to Satan himself. So that whole serpent symbolism seems to be somewhat significant there as well. Okay, let's try to get through lecture 14. I want to begin, I think this is in your notes, but let me put up here. I'm going to talk about the literary structure of Exodus 12 through 15 just briefly. Because sometimes if you get the big picture, it can be helpful. But this actually starts at chapter 11. You've got three narratives in this section. You've got the narrative in chapter 11 that announces the death of the firstborn, and that in essence announces the 10th plague. Then you have a series of regulations given. Passover is described, what they're to do, what they do, unleavened bread feast. And then 12, 21 through 28, get ready for what's coming tonight. Then you have another narrative, which is the Exodus described. Then you have further regulations. Passover, unleavened bread, just like up here, and then regulations related to the firstborn. Then you have narrative that describes their crossing the Red Sea. And following that narrative, there are not regulations, there's celebration. Exodus 15, with the song of Moses and Miriam, God's people celebrate their redemption. So that's sort of the structure. Narrative, regulations, narrative, celebration. Once they've crossed the Red Sea. And part of the question is, why are these regulations here twice? And there is an answer to that we will get to fairly shortly. Now let's sort of work our way through the first narrative is announcing the death of the firstborn, which is sort of the culmination of the plagues, chapter 11. And you have the vindication of Moses in chapter 11, verse 3, and just the devastating nature of this last plague. This last plague is going to affect everybody, 11:5. All the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on the throne to the firstborn of the female servant who is behind the handmill and all the firstborn of the animals. The God angle, perhaps, going on there. So this is sort of the announcement of the death of the firstborn in chapter 11. Chapter 12 describes the Passover, and I just want to comment briefly on several facets of the Passover. A lamb is chosen without blemish, a male 1 year old. And that lamb is slain. The blood of the lamb is put on the doorpost of the house. That's the place of entry. It also may signify security. Other nations might put images on their doorposts for protection. Israel is to put the blood from the lamb that will offer protection. protection. So once the blood is on the doorpost, they are told, don't go out of the house. You're safe in the house, but if you go out of the house, not necessarily safe. The lamb is roasted whole. None of it is left till morning. This is also a meal that is to be eaten together as a community. Bitter herbs are used. And that usually is an explanation to the bitterness of their bondage in Egypt. Chapter 12, verse 8. And then, chapter 12, verse 11. You shall eat it with a belt on your waist, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. The first fast food. You shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. And so on that night, if there's blood on the doorposts, they will not experience this last plague. The regulations related to unleavened bread. Beginning with Passover, the people are to eat unleavened bread for 7 days and have a special feast on the first day and the seventh day. And the primary reason for this is stated in 12:17, you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on this same day I will have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. That's the reason. No leaven seems to fit the idea of haste. There's not time to allow the bread, the leaven to do its work for the bread to rise. And then finally Moses gives instructions in chapter 12, into chapter 12, well, 12, 21 through 28. Go get ready for this night. The next narrative is the Exodus and the effect of the 10th plague. And again, every household is affected. Pharaoh and the people now want them to leave. And you can see this stated in 12:31. He called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, rise, go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go serve the Lord. Remember, that came up early on in Exodus. Go serve the Lord as you have said. It's interesting that they go out from Egypt a mixed multitude. 12:38 says that a mixed multitude went up with them also in flocks and herds and a great deal of livestock. So apparently people took the opportunity to get out of town, to get out of Egypt with the children of Israel. And the fact that they come out of Egypt as a mixed multitude explains why a second set of Passover regulations are given. Because in the second set of Passover regulations, it becomes very clear who may partake of the Passover. Only those who are a part of the congregation, evidenced by circumcision, can eat the Passover. So that is now made very clear, partly because a mixed multitude came out of Egypt, not just Israelites, but others with them. The firstborn regulations, which also follow. Yes, you have a question? I guess I'm assuming, I'm trying to think of a reason why they would not have circumcised. That's very possible.
Right.
Yeah. I'm assuming to some degree that the Israelites were carrying out circumcision, and that this group that came out, you know, Some of them may have been affected by the 10th plague and maybe even believed in Yahweh watching all this. Some Egyptians may have believed in Yahweh watching all this. Others may have just seen this as a good opportunity to get out of Egypt. Yes, sir. Wait.
The firstborn of the animals, do you think this is like all the animals in Egypt or just the domesticated animals like the birds and the flocks?
I don't know for sure.
Like the firstborn of every rat, the firstborn of every roach.
Why not?
And God can do anything.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know. I've never thought about it. If a lot of these other things are connected to God's, then I would say it may be fairly extensive.
Yes. Getting back to his question, yes. Joshua 5, when they're in the land, it says Joshua had to circumcise them because all the men who were old enough to bear arms when they left Egypt had died in the wilderness.
Right.
And those who left Egypt have all been circumcised. But none of those born after the Exodus, during the years of the wilderness, had been circumcised.
That's a good point. So those who left Egypt were circumcised. Yeah, I mean, circumcision fell away in the wilderness, but that clearly makes a good connection. Thanks.
Was it the firstborn male woman? And I know there's later in the law, I guess.
Well, it's always the firstborn males that have to be redeemed. I don't know for sure. I would lean toward the fact that it might be the firstborn males, but I don't know at this stage whether one or the other is, how significant that might be. Yes?
The fact that they didn't circumcise the wilderness, was that disobedience or just sort of out of necessity?
It was an apostate generation.
Right.
They were not following
God. Okay. So, I mean, they understood it and just let it slide. It wasn't sort of like, we're on the go, we don't have means to do this.
No, yeah, that's not, they could have done it.
If I had read a few more verses more, it says they were an apostate generation, and they weren't obeying God, and God suffered them during that time, and it was a stench to him to see.
And when we get there, you're going to see why that is. I mean, it's their disobedience. These firstborn regulations in this second set of regulations now clarify to some degree, or at least mention specifically, the firstborn belongs to God. And so your firstborn is to be redeemed. You don't sacrifice your firstborn son. And if you have animals that are unclean, you don't offer them as sacrifices, but you redeem them. So, in light of all we've seen about the firstborn in the Exodus and the plague, now God says the firstborn belongs to me. And it goes back directly to the plague. Egypt claimed authority over God's firstborn. 422, God showed his authority over Egypt by taking her firstborn. And so now Israel must set aside her firstborn in honor of Yahweh and what he has done for them. Now, obviously, the whole term firstborn literally means in these regulations the one who's born first. But the whole concept of firstborn becomes significant later on in Scripture, where it is metaphorically used, not as the one who's born first, but as the one who has first right. And you see this in reference in Psalm 89:27, in referring to David as God's servant. You know, David wasn't literally the firstborn, but it says, "I will make him my firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth." And their firstborn and highest of the kings of the earth are parallel to each other. So firstborn also comes to mean that one that has the highest rank. And so when Colossians 1:15 says of Jesus, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation, he has the highest rank over all creation. And you don't have to press this, as some cults do, that Jesus was the first one who was created, the firstborn one in that sense. Now, in all these regulations, and I have some of this listed in your notes, there is looking ahead to the future and instructing the next generation. That's key in all of these regulations, looking ahead to the future and instructing the next generation so that they too will know and understand what God has done for his people. And obviously, baptism and the Lord's Supper. Lord's Supper was instituted at a Passover meal. Also have that same significance to us, as well as other significance as what beyond that. Now, we come to the crossing of the Red Sea. 13:17. And it begins to describe that God is leading them, and he's guiding them by a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, 13:21 and 22. The Lord went before them in a pillar of cloud to lead them in the way. So God is leading them. He's guiding them, and we are going to see that this pillar of fire and pillar of cloud in some sense may also be a protection in some situations. Yet, in chapter 14, it looks like the Israelites are lost in the wilderness. But that's by design. 14:2, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before this place, between Migdol and the sea opposite Baal Zephon, and you shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say to the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land, the wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and his army. From Pharaoh's perspective, it looks like they're lost. They've lost their way. And he thinks this is a great opportunity to go and get them back. And so that's what he does. But in reality, God is setting this up as a way to show his honor over Pharaoh. And so the people take it as a great shock when they realize the Egyptians are hot on their trail. And they are sort of caught, and they are very much afraid. And they sort of complain against Moses, why have you brought us out here to die? Were there no graves in Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt? Say, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. This attitude is going to become rampant among the Israelites as we progress in their history. But Moses has to redirect their thinking. You know, look to Yahweh and watch what he will do for you. Verse 14, the Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. And so the children of Israel began to cross the Red Sea. And God divides the sea so that they can go across on dry ground. And the Egyptians try to follow and pursue after them. And 14:24 says, it came to pass in the morning watch that Yahweh looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud. That's pretty ominous, isn't it? And he troubled the army of Egypt, or you could translate that confused. And I like the way that New King James puts this next phrase. He took off their chariot wheels so that they drove them with difficulty. Yeah, I guess if you take off their chariot wheels, they're not going to be able to drive those chariots very easily. Now, what do some of your other translations say? Is it about the same thing? What's made the wheels of the chariots come off? So they had difficulty driving them. Yeah. Anybody got the ESV? I didn't check it. Read it for us, if you would. Yeah, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. There's a word here that can mean take off. There's a word that's used that can mean turn aside. So it's some think that chariot wheels get bogged down in sort of the floor of the Red Sea, and their axles then get broken. Sure. What does it say?
The Lord is fighting for Israel against us.
Yeah, that's the key. They recognize Yahweh, the Lord, is fighting for Israel against us. I mean, for some way, they understood that. Now, maybe they'd seen all these plagues, and they'd come to see, you know, Yahweh's got some power. So that's the key. An acknowledgement that Yahweh is fighting for his people and delivering his people. And the Israelites see this, 14:31. Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. They have faith. And this then leads to this celebration, this song of Moses and song of Miriam. They believe, they respond in faith. And they rejoice. They sing together of God's salvation. A redeemed people should be a singing people. We should be a singing people, shouldn't we? Because of what God has done. Verses 1 through 12, praise God for his triumph at the sea. And it's very clear in these verses that Yahweh is a warrior. The whole concept of a divine warrior who fights for his people is very clear here, evidenced in this part in the song that was sung. He has triumphed gloriously, the horse and rider. He's thrown into the sea. Verse 3 specifically, the Lord is a man of war. Yahweh is his name. And it goes on, Pharaoh's chariot and his army, he's cast into the sea. And we're going to see this thing developed in the book of Joshua and then throughout the rest of the Bible. God fights for his people and he will deliver his people. There's also a forward look in Exodus 15, verses 13 through 18, which describes the impact of the Exodus and the plagues and the crossing of the Red Sea, the impact that this has on the Canaanites. In verses 14 through 18, the people will hear and be afraid. Sorrow will take hold of the inhabitants of Philistia, so beyond Canaan. The chiefs of Edom will be dismayed, the mighty men of Moab. All the inhabitants of Canaan will melt away. Fear and dread will fall on them by the greatness of your arm. And so this was something that brought dread into those surrounding nations when they heard of this great victory that God brought to his people. Now, at the end of chapter 15, There are three incidents. There's progression in these episodes, and they all relate to the complaining of God's people. And so let's look at these three incidents. The first one, end of chapter 15, 22 through 27. Bitter water that they could not drink. They cross the Red Sea. They're in the wilderness. They wilderness ashore. They're 3 days in the wilderness. They have no water. They come to Marah in verse 23. They could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. And so verse 24 says, the people complained against Moses. God responds to this complaint by instructing them and by testing them. And the statute that he gives to them comes in verse 26. If you diligently heed the voice of Yahweh your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all the statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. If you will obey me, I will not inflict upon you those things which I inflicted upon the Egyptians, which probably includes those plagues. But I think it can even be broader than that, because God says, I am the God who heals you. So affliction and disease, God says, I will bless you with health. I will put none of those on you if you will obey me. And then God provides water for them to drink. So you have a complaint basically against Moses. You have a limited regulation given in verse 26. And then you have God's provision for his people. He provides what they need. He provides water. The second complaint, chapter 16. Not enough food. And in this complaint, it's broader than just against Moses. This complaint is against Moses, Aaron, and verse 7, even against the Lord. So this is a broader complaint. The whole congregation complains. Now, the first complaint just said the people complained. Here it's emphasized in verse 2, the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And their complaint is, we remember the great food we had in Egypt. Pots of meat and all we could eat. Why did you bring us out here to this wilderness? People's memories are so short, aren't they? And it's no different when you get into ministry. In response to this complaint, there is detailed regulations given. So here you've got the second complaint. It's against Moses, Aaron, and Yahweh, and it's the whole people, whole congregation, not just the people. And now you have extensive regulation given, limited regulation. With the second complaint, it's broader. God gives extensive regulation, much instruction, and this instruction is related to the manna that he is now going to provide for them. And this instruction relates to their what they are to do, how they're to collect the manna, They're to collect only the amount that they need every day. They're not to keep any overnight except for the sixth day. On the sixth day, they are to collect twice as much because they are not to go out and collect on the seventh day. And so you have these detailed instructions related to God giving the manna. And again, Yahweh is testing his people. As it says in verse 4, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota. I will, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. So this is a test. And of course, some of the people have to learn to follow the instructions because they don't do what God had commanded them to do. But here God provides for them food. And they will eat this manna until they come into the land of Canaan and start eating the food that is in the land of Canaan. So there is a progression here. It, a stronger statement about who complains, who the complaint is against, much greater regulation given, instructions given, and God provides what they need. He provides manna. Now, the third complaint. Chapter 17. It also relates to water. There was no water for them to drink, it says in verse 1. So they contended against Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. Now here, the word for complain, they contended against Moses, is a much stronger term than the term used in the first two. In the first two, I think the term is lean. In this one, it's reem. Hold it. You can't combine Hebrew and transliteration. It just doesn't work. It's reem, which is a very strong term, and it's used in the prophets for a covenant lawsuit. So this is a very strong term to describe their complaint against Moses. Now, the way God responds here is very interesting. In the first two, he responded with regulations. In this complaint, God says in chapter 17, verses 5 and 6, go on before the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river, and go. Verse 6, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, so that the people may drink. You catch what's going on here? Take your rod, and go to the rock, and you're going to strike the rock. Where will Yahweh be? On the rock. And through that, I will provide for my people. As important as regulations are, and the law is coming up, and that's very significant, ultimately, it's God providing for his people through himself being struck. And obviously we understand this much clearer from our place in redemptive history and in history. We're post-cross and resurrection. But Yahweh is on the rock as Moses strikes it. This section ends Well, not quite at the end. The section ends, the chapter doesn't end. Verse 7, talking about he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the contention of the children of Israel and because they tempted or tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? See, God was testing them, but here they were testing the Lord. And this is a problem with the children of Israel. Is the Lord among us or not? As if there wasn't plenty of evidence for that. Well, that question is answered by the events that follow. Is Yahweh among us? Well, what happens in chapter 17, verses 8 through 16? The Amalekites are defeated. The Amalekites came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Joshua leads a group out to fight the Amalekites, and Moses and Aaron and Hur go up to the top of a hill, and Moses has the rod in his hand, and as long as he holds up the rod, Israel prevails, but he gets tired. His arm gets heavy, and when he starts to get tired, Israel does not prevail, and so he must be propped up. Aaron and Hur help hold up the rod so that Joshua is able to defeat the Amalekites. Is Yahweh among Israel? Yes. He wins the victory. Obviously, there are humans involved here. Joshua is leading an army. Moses is holding up the rod. And the rod held up by Moses probably represents the appeal to God to fight on Israel's behalf. I think it's legitimate. Some question this, but I think it's legitimate to look at the rod as an appeal to Yahweh, and that's very similar, is it not, to prayer. In our praying, we appeal to God, and this prayer and this appeal comes in the midst of warfare. Now, the warfare we fight is a little bit different than the warfare they fought, as we will maybe talk a little bit more about this over in the book of Joshua, but I think it is important to understand prayer, appealing to God, in the context of what we consider to be spiritual warfare, because we are involved in a spiritual battle. And we don't always think of prayer in that way, in terms of being a part of our weaponry that God has given to us to fight the enemy. And so I think you can make connections here. Is Yahweh among us or not? Yes, God brought victory over the Amalekites. Is Yahweh among us or not? Well, in chapter 18, you have a Midianite, Jethro's father-in-law, giving praise to God. When he hears of all that God has done for Israel, he rejoices, verse 9, for all the good which the Lord had done for Israel. And he says, blessed be the Lord who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. So he hears what has been done, And he gives honor and praise to God. This is the proper response. You have a Midianite who gives the proper response to God. You have the Israelites who are complaining and are questioning. Is God really among us or not? And then finally, the end of chapter 18, Moses gets some good father-in-law advice from Jethro. You have an example of somebody doing too much. In verse 18, both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out, for this is too much for you. You are not able to perform it by yourself. Moses was teaching the people, and he was judging all the disputes between the people. And if how they've acted so far is any indication, there are probably a lot of disputes among the people. And so Jethro's advice is, Moses, you should keep teaching the people. They need to be taught. But you should appoint qualified leaders to hear the disputes between the people, men of integrity who fear God. And then if there are any difficult matters, those things could be brought to you. And Moses, in his wisdom, listens to Jethro. And does this. The significance of this, it shows us the importance of the plurality of leadership. As significant as Moses is, he cannot do everything. And so the plurality of leadership is significant. It shows the importance of the teaching function and the judicial function. Those things go together. But part of what the elders do in a church is to have that judicial function. And you can see it at work here. It also points to the importance of the law of God, which hasn't been given yet, but is about to be given. Because for their to be the judging of disputes, the law of God will be extremely important to enable these leaders to judge the disputes that God's people have. And so this points forward to the detailed regulations that will be given in chapters 19 through 24. So there are some interesting and significant things related to this, and Moses would have been greatly helped by these things. Any comments or questions? Yes, sir.
Is Paul in 1 Corinthians? Isn't this passage?
Yes. There's a whole in fact, there's a Jewish tradition that grows up around this event. And he sort of alludes to that as well in 1 Corinthians 10. But we'll talk about that. I'm not convinced it has anything to do. Some argue that Yahweh is on the rock here, therefore he can't strike the rock twice, and I'm not sure there's any connection with that. I think when we get over to that place. I think there are other things going on, and it's really Moses' disregard for what God told him to do. I think it's almost as simple as that. Out of his frustration and anger, which is very understandable, he does something that goes against what God, and he takes away from the glory that would have gone to God. And we'll see how that works out when we get over to that passage in the book of Numbers. But there's something else going on there in the book of Numbers that may be significant in relationship to the rock concept. Yes? There is some information about them. I don't know specifically. I don't have that information in front of me. I can get some information about them. I'm sure there's we have some knowledge of who they were. I don't know how much knowledge we have. Critical scholars make a big deal about the Midianites in terms of the origin of Yahweh religion. But we wouldn't want to go down that road. But, well, they don't really believe what is presented in the text. And so where did the origin of Yahweh come from? Well, it must have come from Moses' father-in-law. That's where all these things came from. You see, which is not the way it's presented. It's presented in the text.
In some relation to the Israelites, not like as opposed to the Egyptians. I mean, he seems, Jethro in 18 seems very key to, like, it didn't take much persuasion, you know, and it seems, obviously, with an encounter with God on the way to Egypt, that his wife, Moses' wife, and was a believer in that.
That's possible, yeah. Pardon?
Yeah,
and Moses may have had an impact on them, but there does seem to be something there, and somebody raised a question earlier relating it back to, who did you relate it back to? Abraham had a son named Midian. So, maybe there's some connection there. I just don't know for sure, but I'll try to find out more on that level. Anything else? Well, we're pretty much on time, so why don't we call it quits for the day?
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.